Welcome to Wine with Wilson, the podcast about everything to do with that wonderful beverage, wine. I'm Wilson, and I'm the wine director for Wilson Your Wine Butler and for the website Cult Wine. And I'm also a lifelong wine nerd. I've got a whole life's experience of buying, cellaring, and of course, drinking that wonderful beverage, wine. And what I want to do is bring to you some of the history, some of the culture, some of those weird little facts about wine that go beyond what's in your glass and go beyond the supermarket salve that so many of us might enjoy on a Tuesday night. So, without further ado, let's get into Wine with Wilson. At the beginning of this podcast, what we're going to do is go all the way back to the beginning, back to the very first wines that our ancestors might have produced, might have drunk, might have stored, might have enjoyed at feasts. We're going to go and have a look at where wine comes from, at how it was made, and we're going to make some theorizing about what it might have tasted like. Why is this relevant to modern wine drinkers, you may well ask? I think that actually it's really useful to be able to connect a little bit with the history of the beverage we drink, to understand that wine is more than just something that people use to relax or to enjoy with a meal, that wine actually has a connection with who we are as human beings, and that by maybe thinking a little bit about those beverages that our ancestors were creating and drinking and enjoying and drawing onto their tomb paintings and into their vessels and as a key part of their culture and their art, that by understanding that, we might be able to understand a little bit more about ourselves. Well, that all sounds very esoteric, you may say, Wilson. Let's get on to some of the more concrete facts. Where does wine come from? Well, the current people who can claim that they have the oldest vintages are not the people that you might imagine. If you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, I think I probably would have said, where does wine come from? Maybe somewhere in the classical world. I've got lots of pictures in my head of Roman orgies of drunkenness and feasting. And before them, I've got pictures in my head of the symposia of the ancient Greeks, the famous drinking parties at which their philosophers sat around and chatted about the world while enjoying a little glass or indeed a kylix, a bowl of wine. Now, I think we probably have a picture that those things were very erudite discussions between intelligent people. I think they were probably a little more like stag parties, complete with grubby pictures on the wine bowls. But more of that in a later episode. No, the thing is that where wine actually comes from is somewhere where you might not expect. It comes from the country of Georgia. Now, when I say Georgia, you immediately think of the state in the US. No, I'm talking about the country that borders the Black Sea on one side, that has the Caucasus Mountains at the top and Russia above that, and that below it has modern Turkey and Armenia. Georgia is the place that has the bragging rights for having the very first evidence of wine. In fact, the Georgian wine industry manages to say that it has 8,000 vintages. I need to think about that a little bit. 8,000 vintages means 8,000 years of constant wine production. That is, by anybody's measurement, a bloody long time to be making wine. Georgia is a fascinating topic, and it is one that we'll deal with in a lot more detail over some other episodes in this series. But for now, it's useful to know that Georgia has at least 500 indigenous varieties of grape. Now, just for a moment, I want you to challenge yourself and see if you can think about how many grape varieties you know. And I can probably guarantee you that you're going to come up with a figure considerably less than 500. So that evidence alone is enough for us to feel that Georgia is possibly the home of wine. But there's a whole lot more, much more concrete evidence that I'm going to take a little bit of a look at in today's episode. But before we get there into the wonderful world of archaeology, we need to think a little bit about what grapes are, where they come from, and what those original grapevines were like. So, it might surprise you to learn that all, or at least almost all, modern grape varieties, that almost all modern wine is made from a single species of grape. It's called Vitis vinifera, and it's the vine that produces all of the different wines we drink. So it doesn't matter whether you're drinking a delicious Bordeaux blend from France with a whole lot of Cabernet Sauvignon in it, whether you're having a Shiraz from the Barossa Valley in Australia, whether you're drinking a Riesling from the Mosel in Germany, or whether you're drinking one of the many amazing wines that we produce here in New Zealand, you are drinking wine that comes from grapes that are all related. They are all the same species. They're just different cultivars. Now, there's some complex biological science involved here, and we might get into that in another episode. But for now, just know that all of your grapes in the glass of wine are Vitis vinifera. And Vitis vinifera comes from what's called the wild Eurasian grapevine. I could give you the scientific name, but to be absolutely honest, I can't pronounce it. So, all of our grapes have probably come from the same varieties of grapevine, from a Eurasian grapevine that grew wild right across, as the name suggests, Eurasia. This grapevine took a long time to be domesticated, and the original grapevines were long, scraggly vines that grew up trees and into the canopy of the forests that would have covered much of the European and Asian continents in past times. And like all the other kinds of cultivars that have now become domesticated, they would have been collected and eaten by the ancestors of people from that part of the world who lived there. Now, what we're talking about is a time called the Neolithic, the New Stone Age, a time when people's life ways were still very transient, when while people might have lived for short periods in villages and camps, that they moved across probably very large amounts of the space during the seasons, following animals, following the crops that they were harvesting, and living what has been at one time called a life that might have been brutish and short. Actually, modern anthropology tells us that the life ways of people who live like this are often very pleasant, with lots of time to think, lots of time to engage in art and storytelling, and all of the things that make culture really interesting. So even though we're talking about people whose tools were mainly made from stone, and people who in very many ways would have looked like they were living very simple lives, that the lives of their minds were just as complex and just as interesting as ours. So I think that's important to note. Here we've got these people who are harvesting the wild produce around them. Where, though, did the wine come from? The hypothesis that has been arrived at is one that I actually rather like. What you've got to imagine is the person out there, possibly with a skin bag, maybe with a big wooden vessel. This is before people started to make pottery, so we're talking about vessels that would have long degraded from the archaeological record. There is a Neolithic gatherer with their, let's imagine, a skin bag in among the forests of Eurasia, collecting these incredible berries from the vines that are growing up through the trees. On one occasion, rather than immediately eating the berries, the bags left by the fire. The pressure of the berries inside the bag eventually means that the juice is released. The heat from the fire warms them, and the natural yeasts that appear on the skins begin that wonderful process of fermentation. A couple of days later, our Neolithic gatherer dips into the bag to eat those berries and discovers that at the bottom of the bag there is a rather delicious liquid. A rather delicious liquid that even after a couple of days has a slightly intoxicating effect. For that Neolithic gatherer, that producer of the very first wine, this must have been revelatory. Now, obviously, we don't know for certain if that's how wine was first produced, but it's a pretty good guess that that may have been exactly what happened. Now, speculation aside, it's an awful long way from a couple of skin bags full of fermenting berries to the huge wine production that we know was occurring throughout massive ancient civilizations. For example, one site in modern Turkey from around about 700 BCE shows that there was wine production of anything up to 500,000 litres in a single site. Now, I want you just to think about that for a moment. What it means is that we're talking about a cellar, a modern cellar, of close to 1 million bottles. That's an awful lot of wine to get drunk in a short period of time. It also suggests to us that people were actually storing wine and keeping it and cellaring it in exactly the same way that we like to do today, that wine even then did develop and improve. Now, the next question you're going to ask me, I expect, is exactly what kind of wine this was. And that is a question that it's very difficult to answer. What we do know is that the wines were probably a little bit more like that modern, trendy kind of wine, orange wine, or amber wine, or skin contact wine, if you prefer that phrase. Now, over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a real shift in the kinds of wines that are popular. Natural wine, organic wine, biodynamic wines have become things that people want to look for. They're buzzwords that many of us who are in the wine industry have heard for a long time. So, what does it actually mean? An amber wine, an orange wine, or a skin contact wine, and if you've seen any of these in the shops, you'll know, has a slightly orange colour to it. They're usually white wines that have spent some time in contact with the skins of the grapes before they're bottled. This gives them a kind of a tannic flavour, that furriness on your teeth when you drink them that we're much more familiar with red wines. So, what we know about ancient wine is that it almost certainly spent an awful lot more time in contact with the skins than modern wine does. To fully understand that, we have to know a little bit about how modern wine's produced. So, when we produce red wines and white wines, we do it a little bit differently. For a standard white wine, what we do is we take our grapes and we press them. From pressing them, we get a little bit of the juice, or in fact quite a lot of the juice, hopefully. That juice is separated from the skins, from the seeds, and from all the other bits of the grape, and it's taken away to be fermented. Once we actually get to that point, there are so many varieties of what you can do with it in terms of fermenting that we won't go into the details. With red wine, on the other hand, the wine, the juice, is left on the skins and sometimes on the seeds and the other parts as well for a period of time. Partially that's to increase the flavours, partially it's about the colour. Now, one thing that you may have realised if you've eaten a lot of grapes is that even grapes with red skins almost always have white flesh. So, for red wine to have that beautiful ruby colour in the glass that we also enjoy, especially in winter, like at the moment, then the wine juice, the grape juice, has to spend some time sitting on those skins to be able to get that flavour. The time spent sitting on those skins getting that flavour is also going to increase things like the tannin. And as we just said, the tannin is that slightly furry feeling on your teeth, that taste reminiscent of tea, which of course also has tannin in it. And one of the things that lots of us are actually looking for in a red wine. So, the ancient wines that our ancestors would have been producing are almost certain, whether they were from red grapes or white grapes, to have been wines that spent probably quite a lot more time on their skins. This means that we know that they were probably, if they were white wines, orange or amber, and if they were red wines, they would have been wines that were highly tannic. I want to explore a lot further about what these kind of ancient wines might have tasted like, but that is a topic for another day. What we're looking at today is quite specifically how we know what is the oldest wine producing nation, what are the oldest wines on earth, where does ancient wine come from? So, to be able to really answer this question, we actually have to turn to the wonderful field of archaeology, and in particular to someone who has become a little bit of a hero for me, a guy called Patrick McGovern, who's written an incredible book called Ancient Wine, based on the years and years of biomolecular research that he's done as an archaeologist who's focused on finding the origins of ancient foods and wines. What sort of use does this have to humanity? Well, I'm going to leave you to answer that question, but for me, the answer to that is that knowing just a little bit more about what our ancestors ate and drank, what their lives were really like, having that deep sensual connection with our ancestors, I think tells us a little bit more about our connection with the past and hopefully tells us a little bit more about who we are as human beings. So, Patrick McGovern, for a long time, had been hunting for the origins of wine. How was he going to be able to discover where wine came from? That's a useful question. What he had realised over a long period of time, that there was going to have to be a connection of a whole lot of different evidence. There's lots of evidence from archaeological sites of things like grape pips. They actually survive particularly well, especially if they've been carbonised, if they've been burned in some way. And by being able to look at those grape pips and being able to decipher whether or not they were domesticated grapevines or whether they came from a wild grapevine, it was reasonably easy to work out whether or not there was some sort of wine industry. If there was a whole lot of domesticated grapevines, that suggested the bulk production of those grapes and therefore the suggestion that there was probably wine being produced. But all of this is evidence which is just inference and not actually the kind of concrete evidence that we'd need to be able to start to date when wine production might have occurred somewhere. Where all of his investigations leads Patrick McGovern is to start to look at what's left on the inside of clay vessels. How does he do that? He does it through biomolecular archaeology, through the biomolecular exploration of the things that are left on the inside of vessels. So what this means is doing a whole lot of extremely detailed chemical research about the residues that remain on the sorts of vessels that might have been used for holding wine What specifically is he looking for when he's looking at these residues? He's looking in particular for something called tartaric acid. Tartaric acid, when it's found in large enough quantities, is an almost precise indicator that wine has been present. Tartaric acid is specific to grapes and becomes much more concentrated during the production of wine. So, if you can find evidence of a large buildup of tartaric acid on the inside of a vessel, then you can be pretty certain that at some point in its history, that vessel was being used to hold wine. The big breakthrough for Patrick McGovern and the first indication that wine production goes back thousands of years was from a site in modern-day Iran called Göden Tepe. Their friend had been involved in looking at the results of a previous excavation and had found a whole range of shards, broken parts, of two large pots. They were very distinctive pots. They had some quite strange sort of U-shaped decorations that looked like a braided rope. They were tall vessels with very narrow necks that showed evidence that that neck had been carefully chipped away, something that was recognised from much later amphora, which are the great big clay vessels from the classical era that were used to contain wine, and where the tops are sometimes chipped away so that the stopper of clay doesn't interfere with the wine before you start to pour it. These large clay vessels from Göden Tepe in modern-day Iran had the distinctive shape at the top that showed that they'd been chipped away to get rid of a stopper. And very strangely, they had a small hole towards the bottom, a hole that had been very carefully drilled. What we now think is that that hole was drilled just above where the lees, where the dead yeast was sitting in these vessels, that the wine had been left to age within them, that the lees had fallen to the bottom, much as you might see in a modern natural wine when there's a sediment at the bottom of it, and that the hole had been drilled so that as the wine was decanted, it would have been clear and fresh and away from the lees. So, there's a whole lot of things about these vessels that make them look like they may have contained wine. But the thing that seemed to be pointing to it the most was a thick red residue, particularly towards the bottom, where the lees, where the dead yeast would have been at its thickest. When these vessels were analysed using the biomolecular techniques, it was indeed discovered that there was massive amounts of tartaric acid. These were vessels that had contained wine. Alongside of this, these vessels were able to be reliably dated to well over 3000 BCE. In other words, 5,000-year-old wine jars. From what would have been, by all accounts, a 5,000-year-old party to end all parties. It looks like in the room where these vessels were held, there was also evidence of a whole lot of rather exquisite jewellery. It does seem that in some ancient party time, someone got so intoxicated that they threw off their beautiful jewels while drinking the wine from these wonderful containers. It's a nice little addition to the story that I find quite amusing and that connects us, I think, very much to the people who are drinking this wine. That's a long way away, 5,000 years ago, but it's also a long way from the Transcaucasus region, from the region of Georgia, where they're claiming 8,000 vintages, not 5,000 years of history, but 8,000 years of history. The connection to Georgia is a lot more complicated. Patrick McGovern, who has been doing all of this research, had long ago made a connection between the modern wine industry in Georgia and the evidence from the ancient wine industry. For example, ancient vessels found in the area of Georgia had on them quite strange pictures which seemed to show figures with their arms upraised and seemed to show sort of a space, a building, a little bit like a modern gazebo, and with things twirling around the limbs of this gazebo. It wasn't until one afternoon when he was sitting drinking a glass of wine on the balcony of his hotel and he looked out to see where the modern grapevines were being grown around the hotel that he realized that the modern forms of pergola that were being used to grow grapevines, where the vines were growing up the upright posts of the pergola and across the top, very much in the same way that we might grow vines today over our patio to make it a pleasant place to sit during the summer, that these looked exactly like the pictures that he'd been seeing on very, very ancient pottery vessels from the area. So there were some clues starting to come together. Along with that is a very complicated story about the Indo-European language. Now, this is a podcast about wine, not about linguistics, so we're not going to go into the details of the proto-Indo-European language, but linguistic studies had also linked some of the most ancient words for wine to the Transcaucasus region, to the region of modern Georgia. The evidence is starting to build up, but what he really needed was that concrete evidence, pottery, which actually showed that there had been wine produced. And it's in 2017, actually only 7 years ago, that finally an excavation within modern Georgia was able to reveal pottery, which demonstrated that 8,000 years ago, there was full-scale wine production already happening in Georgia. The same tartaric acid that had been found in the Göden Tepe vessels was present on the shards of pottery, the broken pieces of pottery that had been excavated in Georgia. It was a really important discovery for the Georgian wine industry and pushing back the history of wine even further than it had already been pushed. Now the thing is that Patrick McGovern and other people working in this industry think that the actual date is probably even earlier. And we're still waiting for modern excavations to maybe find us something that shows us that wine was being produced even before 8,000 years ago. I think that that will mean that the Georgian wine industry will have to change a whole lot of its advertisements and change it from 8,000 vintages to something a little bit older. But there's also other countries in the region that possibly could claim to be the oldest wine producers. And excavations in Armenia may well demonstrate that, in fact, it's actually across the border where wine was first produced. So, wine. It has a history of at least 8,000 years. The question you're going to ask me now is, how do I get to taste any of these amazing wines? And they are amazing. Well, if you're here in New Zealand, your chances of getting a Georgian wine are not particularly high. We have some wines from a wine producer called Taliani Valley, who are a little bit like the Villa Maria of New Zealand, of Georgia. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. They're a huge producer who makes wines at a whole range of different levels, but they also make wine in one of the most ancient methods by which wine was made. The other wine that you'd be likely to be able to find in New Zealand if you're looking for Georgian wines is wines called Phoenix Tears, many of which are also made in very ancient ways and which are all using indigenous varieties of grapes, some of those 500 indigenous varieties that we talked about a little bit earlier in the show. So, if you do get hold of one of these wines, what are they going to be like? These are wines that have been made in a traditional vessel called a quevri. And what a quivry is basically a very, very large pottery vessel. Some of them are at least as big as I am, and I'm only 5 foot two, but that's still quite large for a pottery vessel. Many of them even larger than that, and able to fit full-grown men who have to get in them to clean them out, which is another part of the story. These quivries, in Georgia at least, are buried up to their necks in order to keep them at an even temperature. The grapes, often the stems, and this includes the skins and the seeds, are put into the quivry. Sometimes they're pressed, sometimes the natural weight of the grapes is used to press them. And the quivries are sealed while the grapes ferment and then age. What you get as a result, after maybe 18 months, is a wine which, whether it's made from a white grape or a red grape, is going to be tannic, is going to be maybe a little bit oxidized. The white wines often taste of nuts, of fruit, but they're also going to have a sparkling acidity. They're going to be absolutely delicious, and they're going to taste quite different from any modern wine that you've tasted. And they're going to taste different from how those grapes will taste if they're made in more traditional winemaking methods like we're used to drinking from the wines on our supermarket shelves. So, if you want to taste a little bit of what an ancient wine might have been like, you're going to have to find yourself some Georgian wine. If you live outside New Zealand, that's going to be an awful lot easier for you. I'd love to hear about your experiences with Georgian wines or with any ancient wines, and I'd love to hear your questions. You can always get in touch at wilsonyourwinebutler@gmail.com. This has been Wines with Wilson. It's been a pleasure sharing this time with you, and cheers. Until next time.